Hello. What would happen to the BBC under a Labour government? I scanned Labour's manifesto launched last week and found, well, virtually nothing. All it said was this: we will work constructively with the BBC and our other public service broadcasters so they continue to inform, educate and entertain people and support the creative economy by commissioning distinctively British content. Not exactly detailed. However, there might be some good news on the horizon for the World Service, as the manifesto also says, at home, Conservative attacks on our globally respected institutions, university, courts and the BBC, have undermined our soft power, traditionally a source of great strength, and diminished our influence. As to what they will do to rectify that alleged undermining, again, no detail. Can't wait for the next government's first big bust-up with the BBC. It usually doesn't take long coming. Meanwhile, back to the election. How well are the broadcasters doing? Who better to ask than my namesake Adam Boulton? Adam has spent more than 30 years at Sky News, 25 of those as political editor. He's been the host for general and US elections coverage, invigilated the first leaders' debate in 2010, and has the distinction of having interviewed every UK Prime Minister since Sir Alec Douglas Hume. He continues to write for Sky, but is also now broadcasting on Times Radio, where he co-hosts the weekend flagship politics show, Sunday Morning, with Kate McCann, and he's a regular panellist on Talk TV. Adam Boulton, very nice to meet somebody who has a U in their name as opposed to a non-U person like myself. Are you enjoying this campaign? It's hardly your first.
No, I think it's my 11th as a working journalist, and about the 13th, I can remember, I was first eligible to vote in 1979. In fact, that's the last time I did vote.
But that's because as a political journalist, you don't think you should, or because you can't choose?
No, the former. I mean, I've just always felt if you're getting as close as political editors do to everybody, it's much better to take yourself and your own personal feelings out of the equation. And also, I think it helps you, if you're not being partisan, helps you scrutinise what's going on better. So that's been my choice. I mean, David Frost, who I used to work with once, said to me, oh, well, I couldn't possibly vote because they're all my friends. not quite my attitude, but I know what he was getting at.
Yeah, but are you enjoying it? I mean, I've read you saying it, for example, after the ITV debate, where there were rather large number of people on the stage and rather large number of questions, that you had your head in your hands afterwards. Do you think it's been a good, is a good campaign so far in terms of the way the broadcasters have organised things as opposed necessarily to the way the answers given by politicians?
I think it's been a good campaign because until now it's been surprisingly eventful. I'm not too sure how many twists and turns they're really going to be between now and polling day. I think from the point of view of the broadcasters, it's been a mixed campaign. And the point I was making about my head in my hands is that, as you may know, I've for a long time thought that in an era when politicians basically tend to be avoiding extended news conferences and extended interviews, that at election times, the best way to get them on the record is by having formalized debates. I think we did achieve that in 2010, and Sky News, which I was working for, was very much an instigator of that. But I had my head in my hands because I think that the versions of debates which we've had since, particularly those done by the BBC and ITV, have been more entertainment and less information. And I do think that those multiple sort of scrum down debates are very, very difficult to control, particularly when, as we've seen, we've had some participants, notably Penny Morden and Angela Rayner, and to a certain extent Nigel Farage, prepared not to make any attempt to respect the rules of fairness.
I mean, what surprises me, or rather slightly worries me, is that it's a time when we need detailed examination of policy, particularly of, shall we say, populists or people like Nigel Farage. Take, for example, his immigration policies and his promise to end immigration and return, I think, immigrants to France. He makes that statement. I can't remember seeing a programme in which there's been sufficient time to explore how he would do this. Would he sort of parachute people, refugees into France? Would he run the gauntlet of the French Navy? I mean, how would it work? How would he get France's cooperation on such matters? There seems to be little time in the debate for the exploration of the implementation of policy, as opposed to, as it were, positions which are just stated baldly.
Yeah, I think what you've just said about Nigel Farage, those are all very good questions. And he, incidentally, appears to be one of the people who is avoiding a lengthy sit down on any subject. I mean, he was due to do one, I think, with Nick Robinson on the BBC, but that's been postponed at least twice, as far as I can tell. I do think we collectively in broadcast and I think the BBC in particular do have a case to answer over Nigel Farage. I mean, the truth is that he played the media like a fiddle, didn't he? The first week of the campaign, he got coverage, including another seat on BBC Question Time, by saying, well, I'm going off to America, so I'll only be here for a week, so you better give me all the coverage you can. He duly got it. And then the next week, he changed his mind and duly got all the coverage all over again because he had decided he was going to come into the campaign. And then in the third week, Reform by then had regrouped and was announcing its policies. But as you say, not in the context, frankly, that anyone was really taking them seriously. Nonetheless, the problem is that you can do analyses of the policies. Certainly, Sky News and the BBC have tried that. And we've also seen the IFS. But the public simply sees the headlines and the bold persona. And it is difficult to know how you can make that cut through, particularly when Farage starts by saying, well, of course, I'm not going to win this election. So at that point, what's the point of scrutinising the details of his policy? You've just got to feel the emotion.
But it really is all about, it's all basically simple if you're a Farage person. It's all just them against you. There's a conspiracy. It's the other. If only I was here, I would solve all these problems. But actually, I don't. I'm not going to answer questions about how I would solve them. I mean, you've made another remark where you were saying that, you did assume and you did think until relatively recently that leading politicians were perhaps primarily there or started their careers, certainly in the belief that they wanted to serve, genuinely serve and help things. And over the last few years, perhaps, you don't think that's the case. It's promoting themselves first. It's rather a pessimistic but perhaps understandable view. Do you still hold to it?
Yes, I do broadly, partly because I know a lot of people who I think in previous generations would have been tempted to go into politics but have decided that they can be of more use away from elected politics, and partly because we have to look at the field of people who over the past 50 years have become politicians. And I think there have been more people who are in it for themselves and in it for promoting themselves. You know, one could look at Boris Johnson on one side or Jeremy Corbyn on the other, perhaps Jo Swinson, if you remember her, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, people who
short-lived.
Yeah. Short-lived, basically put forward policies which, if they have any detail at all, are impractical. What is interesting about this campaign, and I'm not saying necessarily that I believe him, is that Keir Starmer has actually homed in on this point, and his whole sell to the general public is, I've served in my previous roles as a director of public prosecutions, and he uses this word service very sincerely. Now, if he were to win the election, I think the test will be whether the electorate, which is much less loyal to a particular party, is prepared to stick with him on the hard grind, which one can see in terms of trying to re-establish the UK. Or will they just say, oh, boring, Nigel Farage sounds much more exciting?
Yeah, and they also read, please do it all in 4 years at the most, so we can go in the fifth year to an election. But on the other hand, what's going on here, and you must be very concerned about this, is that as I know, the long-term consequences of the present budgetary arrangements for local councils. Yet who dares raise the question about council tax and what needs to be done? You know the question about social care. Where are the plans about that? The other big question which neither party dare deal with is Brexit. We do have a situation where we're the lowest, I think, public and private investment in the G7. These are formidable problems to deal with, and that's in the hope that, you know, Vladimir Putin doesn't do something increasingly stupid as well. The problems are formidable, and I'm just wondering about not just the openness of leadership, but the ability of leaders to inspire hope and to take the country through. I mean, competence in these circumstances is not enough, is it?
No, it isn't, although I do think, and I don't know how one could do this differently, but I think we in the media do have to accept some of the blame for this, in as much as we have gone down the tram lines, for example, over Labour and Conservatives challenging themselves over the minutiae of their financial plans. And, you know, everyone gets terribly excited that, will the Conservatives manage to get Labour to rule out this plan or that plan? Or are Labour's claims about the Tories' hidden tax plans, are they true? Now, I would argue that basically, economically, in those broad pictures, there's not much difference between the two parties. And what we actually ought to be discussing is, given the hole we're in, are tax cuts, for example, a logical answer or indeed a practical answer to any of those problems which we're in? But we, the interviewers and the commentators, are not really making those arguments, because that's not where the argument has been defined by the politicians. And
that's a good point. I want to pick up on that, because I used to have this 1,000 years ago. The argument when I was in the Growing Current Affairs programs with news people as well, saying, look, of course, politicians set the agenda of the general elections. You have to follow that to a degree. But you also had to have a list of things which are vitally important. And if they don't come up during the election, at a certain point, doesn't the broadcasters have to write to say, you need to be informed about this, the general public, because it's vital? I mean, for example, if we go back to the 70s, Northern Ireland was never discussed. You know, our soldiers were dying. It was costing a great deal of money. Disastrous for the people of Northern Ireland. Never discussed. Too uncomfortable for the front benches. So there's a sort of front bench, I would say, conspiracy of silence, if you like. That's not discussed. Brexit isn't discussed now. Don't the broadcasters have a right at a certain point in the campaign to say, we really have to do this, whether the politicians want it or not? And in this instance, for example, Brexit, we need to look at it.
Well, I would agree with you on that. And in fact, yesterday I was spent all day at a conference, not largely with journalists, but with academics, talking about UK in the EU and what was going to happen in Europe and elsewhere. So I think there is a hunger for that. But I do think there is a problem, which is that if you go back to election campaigns when I started in the 1980s, both the main parties would hold pretty much daily open-ended news conferences with all the journalists. They would also do extended interviews, not just half an hour with, you know, the equivalent of Nick Robinson, but on BBC, ITV, Channel 4, and with the broadsheet newspapers. And that allowed the agenda to be broader, and I think some issues were covered. I mean, particularly if you go right back to Thatcher period, where they would even do extended interviews with local papers in Belfast or wherever. What has happened is that with the arrival of media handlers and spin doctors, the access to politicians has diminished and diminished and diminished, so that very often what you're seeing effectively is the same journalists who are basically embedded with the party leaders only really getting access to ask the questions of the day, which is basically a tick list. And that means broadening the agenda is just practically very, very hard for people to do.
And of course, an additional issue here is what's been happening with digital journalism. And when you left Sky formally in 2021, he talked about baby boomers having their day. Oh, please God, that isn't the case. And the end of the all-powerful anchor. And the view certainly held in Sky, the future of news is digital and based around digital journalism. And we've had this week the digital news report by Oxford University's Reuters Institute, and which does show that audiences for traditional news sources like ITV and print have fallen sharply over the past decade, with younger people preferring to get their news online or via social media. So that's an additional problem. How have you dealt with that? And how do you, at times, radio, when you contribute to that, deal with the fact that the younger audience, on the whole, isn't there.
Well, what is happening with social media is that the mainstream broadcasters or the legacy broadcasters are trying to produce material which can then populate TikTok or Twitter or Facebook in particular. So in other words, what you're seeing is content being generated and then snippets of that being promoted onto the social media areas. And you know, for example, Piers Morgan, in his latest iteration working for News UK at Talk, started out being a nightly broadcaster, if you like, in the image of the anchor. What he's now doing is he's not really broadcasting live at all, as we would understand it. He's doing programs which are then exclusively available online with snippets on the YouTube channels or on other bits of social media, and he's getting significant audience by doing that. But the point about it is it's much more fragmented. It is, by and large, what people are seeing are the classic clips and sound bites rather than sitting down for extended periods of time. But crucially, that monopoly or that ability to control the audience or to control the debate has gone away from the mainstream broadcasters because there's so many other competitors going on. I mean, basically, anybody who has a device like this has the means of potentially reaching millions of eyeballs.
The phone, of course, is to what you're referring. But, I mean, how do you deal with that yourself in your present broadcasting? Isn't somebody whispering in your ear, Adam, where's the news line? Where's the news line? Because you can put the news line out digitally.
No, you see, that is one of the interesting things, that the positives, if you like, for people who would like a more discursive or more analytical approach to news events, is that one of the other things that happened is that in the original broadcasting or the original recording, you have more time. I mean, you and I would never get half an hour to talk like this on, you know, Radio 4. Nonetheless, this is a podcast which lots of people can see, and we know that there are a number of successful podcasts. And likewise, you know, on Times Radio, we can talk, you know, we do 3 hours of politics on a Sunday morning, whereas we know that, you know, the descendants of the Frost program now are sort of down to 50 minutes or so. So, and also it means that we can talk to people who aren't necessarily headliners, whereas that has increasingly become the focus. So that, in a sense, the material is out there in a way it's never been out there before. And you can see think tank reports and discussions and all the rest of it. The problem is, you know, to go back to our old acquaintance, Tony Hall,
former Director General of the BBC and former Director of BBC News, yeah.
Exactly. There is no way of making people, quotes, eat their greens. You know, if people don't want to choose to delve into this wealth of information that's out there, they don't have to, because there's always something else to watch, which again was one of the reasons why I felt debates were so important, because they were live events which did at that time command 10 million, an audience of 10 million, whereas now with the debates we've seen, it's half that, if that.
Well, referring back again to this digital news report by Reuters, it says more people are turning away from news in the UK. Interest has halved since 2015. And one of the reasons given is that people feel powerless. They have no agency over massive things that are happening in the world. Is this a temporary phenomenon, do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was at a discussion with a senior Sun journalist, you know, one of the senior economists, and it was about the election, and he just said, look, really none of this stuff matters because we're in a very dark period in global geopolitics, and we're going to be worried about that next, not about, you know, whether or not there's going to be an increase in the rate of council tax. And I think there is a truth in that, which may be one that comes out of the security situation, but it may also be one which comes out of the economic situation, you know, the pressures on the UK and indeed the West in terms of being able to sustain the sort of societies you know, which we have created.
So, and of course, there's climate change as on top of that. It's
yeah, and there's climate change as well. So there are a lot of really big things out there which make a lot of the politicking seem trivial. And then on top of that, and I do think this is significant, we have had politicians decrying and basically taking the mickey out of what they're doing. I mean, that's what Donald Trump did. That's what Boris Johnson did in this country, actually saying, well, you know, it doesn't really matter, all these technical details and all this media scrutiny. That's just, you know.
We don't need experts anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, famously.
Michael Gove gave experts. That one. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. They're doing all that. And, you know, they're people in positions of political leadership. So it's not surprising that a lot of the people who are getting on with their lives and just paying half attention to this think, well, if they say we needn't bother, why do we need bother?
I'm talking, you know, quietly reasonable and cherubic, if I may say, as usual. But somebody said of you, you are kind but combustible. That was an old friend, Andrew Billen, I think, was interviewing you. And you were you have been a bit combustible, haven't you? I mean, you've been punched by the late, great Chancellor of the Exchequer, Dennis Healey. You shouted at Alistair Campbell.
He shouted at me too, yeah.
He shouted at you too, yeah. But I mean, did you enjoy that at the time? Or there's, say, the row with Alistair Campbell, or was that spontaneous? And have you changed since a bit? Are you less combustible?
Well, I think that you have to be. My whole career covering politics has basically been non-deferential, and I'm not making any boast about that. But I've always thought that, you know, everybody had feet of clay, and you should ask them direct questions and try and get direct answers. And some of the time they'd be right, and some of the times they'd be wrong. And I think quite often, when you get into confrontations with people, certainly Healey, certainly Alistair Campbell, that was partly a deflection mechanism on their part, which they were basically losing the argument.
I should explain for listeners who are less perhaps of our age that the problem with Dennis Healey was he was asked directly, I think, by Anne Diamond about why his wife was having private medical treatment. And the argument, yes, doubtless Healey was generally upset about this because of his wife, whatever, but it did deflect from the question.
Yeah, exactly. He blew up about it because, as we've seen from Keir Starmer in this election campaign, apparently for Labour politicians, that is still a sensitive issue, the use of private medicine. Likewise, with Alistair Campbell, we were talking about whether or not arithmetically Labour could form a coalition after the election of 2010. And the truth was, I'd had a number of senior Labour figures phoning me up saying, look, the maths doesn't add up. It's all over, including members of the current cabinet. Campbell then appears to say, oh, yeah, it's all entirely possible, unelected, no official role in the government, but the only person on the Labour Party who has spoken. So when I challenged those figures, Alistair, who knows me very well, we've known each other for many years, knew how to wind me up, which is by attacking, guess what, my integrity, which is exactly the point I was making about those politicians who choose to undermine us.
Do you kick yourself afterwards? I mean, did you kick yourself for allowing him to get away with it?
Not really, because I felt I had said what I wanted to say. And I can honestly promise you that literally for 2 years afterwards, I had ordinary passers-by coming up to me and saying, congratulations, why didn't you hit him, including police officers on the beat. And on one occasion, walking down Haymarket, and a bus ground to the halt so the driver could come out and give thumbs up. So I think a lot of people felt that resisting the spin was a good thing to do. Not, I hasten to add, that I'm proud of it. I mean, I lost my temper, and I shouldn't have lost my temper, and I shouldn't have let Alistair provoke me. As to whether I've got mellower or not, I don't think I'm any less combative or prepared to stand my ground. But I think that the current generation of politicians tend to be more slippery. I mean, I remember interviewing Boris Johnson down the line, you know, when he was during the Olympics, and he didn't like the interview, and he actually literally wandered off while the interview was underway. and then wrote me a letter afterwards and said, I'm very sorry, you know, I had to go and see such an important dignitary.
There are other
ways of getting around it. And perhaps what I have learnt from the Campbell incident is not to be provoked. But I also think, the one thing I do think is that these spats which you can get into, you never see them coming. They don't happen when you think this is a very difficult interview with someone because they're on the ropes. It tends to come out of the blue when you don't think that things are going to go wrong. And I'm sure you've had exactly the same experience.
Mm. Well, I read you said that, you know, you once interviewed not a politician, Sarah Miles.
Yeah.
And that went entirely wrong.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Well, basically, I asked her if her autobiography was true. And
I.e. not ghosted, yeah.
Well, no, not so much that. But she wrote this memoir which said that she'd had a long affair with Laurence Olivier and she'd had various other lovers. And there was quite an extensive reaction to it. Reviews by people who knew around at the time, theatrical journalists and all that, basically calling all of this into question. So when I came to interview her, I thought, well, I've got to find a subtle way of raising, you know, the questions that have been raised about what she said in her thing. And I thought I came up with a very elegant way of saying it. Was it happened that Clive James had recently written a volume of memoirs which he'd entitled Unreliable Memoirs. So I said to her, thinking I was being very gentle, Clive James, who you know has recently written a book called Unreliable Memoirs, are your memoirs a bit unreliable? And what I was expecting her to do was either to say, well, you know, time passes and we all see things in different ways, or to say, well, you know, there may be one or two things that have been risen I want to correct. Instead of which, she bridled and she said, who says that? And I just reeled off names of about seven reviewers who she knew who had questioned it, at which point she burst into tears. And it got even worse because we thought, right, well,
this is on air.
This is on air, yeah. We thought we'd better have a clip ready. So I said, oh, well, you know, let's have a look at one of your greatest performances. And we cut to a clip from Ryan's daughter, which was her having it off with someone in a wood, which I have to admit, I hadn't previously seen this thing. So it didn't go particularly well.
Well, it's coming to end our conversation, Adam. And the question I always want to ask you is, why on earth haven't you worked for the BBC as its political editor? Now, did they ever approach you? Oh, and did you say no on principle, or did they not offer enough cash?
Certainly not the latter. I had discussions with the BBC. I have worked for the BBC a long time ago, and I had a mentor from the BBC, now dead, a man called Leslie Stone. And we went along, we had lunch with the BBC people, and we both came out and said, well, they're going to give the job to Andrew Marr, aren't they? So there didn't seem any point in pursuing that.
Yeah.
I did get a straight offer from ITV to be the political editor after Michael Brunson, but I just privately decided to turn that down because I thought I had more scope at Sky doing what I was doing then.
And do you still admire the BBC and its news operation, or do you get frustrated with it?
I think it's possible to do both.
admire and be frustrated, yeah.
Admire and be frustrated. And I think, you know, I think there are obviously problems, or there were problems in a lot of my career of the BBC just being so dominant within the market. And perhaps things could have gone the other way. I'm less worried about that now because the market has fragmented. And I think that in many ways, you know, the BBC, whether or not you can call it expansion, has continued doing, you know, a lot of things, educating, informing and entertaining in a way that commercial broadcasters have not managed to do. And I think that what has been important to me is what I call the ecology, which is a slightly sort of pompous word about British broadcasting, which was that from the start, governments here decided that they would set the framework for broadcasting and broadcasting ownership, initially with a BBC monopoly, then with a duopoly, and then with the other channels coming in, satellite channels and Channel 4 and others coming in the 80s. But everyone played by the same rules in terms of impartiality and in news. And to me, that standard is very, very important. And yes, I am worried that the attitude which the regulators, Ofcom, have taken, for example, towards GB News, is undermining that culture. And I think if we lose it, a bit like the rainforest, we probably won't get it back.
You said GB News should be shut down. You still think that?
Yeah, I think GB News as a broadcast channel should be shut down. I don't think if it wants to go online and do its stuff, which may well be where broadcasting is emigrating, you know, I believe in freedom of speech, but I don't think GB News should be given the imprimatur of a national broadcaster with the standards which is following, with the clear repeated political bias and defiance of the rules. And you know, when you get Rishi Sunak calling GB News first at his news conference, that is a statement, and it's not a happy statement for the state of our democracy.
And so would you go as far to say that the maintenance of the survival of the BBC as an impartial source of news was an essential element of our democracy, or is that putting it too high?
Yes, I would say that. I would say it was essential, but I would also say that it created an umbrella for the sort of ITV which you worked for, you know, which is still there as a legacy broadcaster with Thames and LWT and all the rest of it. And of course, you know, as we all know, if we look at the history of this, the innovators within those rules tended to be the independent channels, and then the BBC tended to occupy that territory afterwards, sometimes when the commercial channels, you know, were no longer prepared to fund it. So I think it's been a very good and constructive symbiotic relationship between the BBC and the independents. And I think, you know, and it's amazing, I think, to a certain extent, that has been sustained for, you know, 50 years. The issue is whether it can be sustained for another 50 years.
And what about you? What can you sustain? I mean, if this election goes to plan, it looks as though the Labour will get a very large majority, which makes us assume there won't be another election for 5 years' time. Do you want to be at the next election if it isn't 5 years' time and not just as an observer?
Yeah, I do. I mean, you know, we're all getting old. And I do think, you know, as I said in the interview you talked about with my friend Andrew Billen, I do think you have to accept that things move on. You have to step aside. But I think my state pension retirement age is 67, I think. I'm not 67 yet. And I think it's generally accepted that most people are viable till about 70, 75. So in my mind, probably the cutoff is the next election rather than this one, you know, partly because I think, you know, I mean, the government says I'm supposed to be working, so it's best to do that.
Well, so there's still time for you to go and work for the BBC. Right, Adam Bolton, thank you very much for talking to us.
That was a great pleasure, Roger. Thank you.
Our thanks to Adam Bolton. And please do support our journalism by either a one-off payment on our crowdfunding page or regularly by signing up to patreon.com/beepwatch for £1.99 per month. By signing up to Patreon, this will also entitle you to my weekly blog, which gives my take on the week's interview. You don't have to read it. The link to this and our crowdfunding page can be found in the description of this programme. And that's it for this week. And as you know, this podcast is presented by me, Roger Bolton, and it's produced by Kate Dixon. The sound is by Dave Kitto, and special thanks to Quinn Genty. It's a Good Egg production. Goodbye.